Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We all have horror stories of bad bosses. Kim Scott would know. She was one of them. Now she's on a mission to rid the world of terrible bosses. As a former exec at Apple and Google, Scott preaches the concept of radical candor. She says it can revolutionize office culture if you do it right. This hour On Point, radical candor and building better bosses. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What makes a good boss a bad one? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Stanford, California, is Kim Scott, author of Radical Candor, Be a Kick-Ass Boss Without Losing Your Humanity. You can find an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Kim is CEO of Candor, Inc. It's a leadership development company. She worked at Apple, at Google, led three startups herself. Kim Scott, thanks very much for being with us today.
Hey, Tom. Great to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
You say in the book you were lousy enough at being a boss to learn something about it. Tell us about the rough stuff before you learned how to do it right.
Absolutely. I'll tell you about probably the worst moment in my career. I had hired this guy, and we'll just call him Bob.
Good.
And I really liked Bob a lot. Bob was smart. He was charming. He was funny. He would do stuff like one time we were at a management offsite playing one of those get-to-know-you games that everybody hates, right? And nobody dares to raise their hand and say this is a ridiculous waste of time. And Bob said, hey, I've got a great idea. Why don't we just go around the table and tell everybody what candy our parents used when potty training us. Weird, but fast. And everybody remembered. Hershey Kisses right here.
Okay.
And then for the next 10 months, every time there was a tense moment in a meeting, Bob would whip out just the right piece of candy for the right person at the right moment. So anyway, I liked Bob. I found this funny, charming.
Yeah.
Only one problem with Bob. He was doing absolutely terrible work, which was a mystery because he had this amazing resume. I learned later the problem was that he was smoking pot in the bathroom every day, which maybe explains
all that.
The candy
was very appealing.
The candy was made a lot more sense. But I didn't know that at the time. And so instead, I liked Bob. I didn't want to hurt his feelings. And I didn't want the whole team, everybody liked Bob. I didn't want them to think I was some kind of jerk or some other word we're not allowed to use.
Yep.
And so I didn't tell Bob that his work wasn't nearly good enough. And over the course of 10 months, I would give him praise that was kind of head fake. Bob, you're so awesome. You're so smart. Mm-hmm. This is a good start, but maybe you could make it a little better. And eventually, the inevitable thing happened. And I realized that if I didn't fire Bob, I was going to lose half my team. I was being unfair to everybody else by not addressing his problems. And when I had the conversation with Bob that I should have had 10 months ago, frankly, when I was finished, he pushed the chair back from the table. He looked at me right in the eye and he said, why didn't you tell me? And as that question is going around in my head with no very good answer, he said, why didn't anyone tell me? I thought you all cared about me. And now I realize that I, as Bob's boss, have failed in six really important ways. I failed to solicit praise and criticism from him. Maybe I was doing something that was driving him to toke up in the bathroom, but I'll never know because I never asked, right? Mm-hmm. I failed to give him praise that was real praise, that was actually meaningful, and I failed to tell him when his work wasn't nearly good enough. And probably worst of all, I failed to create a culture in which everyone on the team would tell Bob what was genuinely good or when he was going off the rails. And because I have failed in these six important ways, Bob's getting fired. That's the worst part about being a boss, is you learn all your hardest lessons on the backs of somebody else. And all I could do in that moment, it was too late to save Bob. All I could do in that moment was make myself a really solemn promise that I would never make that mistake again, and that I would work really hard to help everybody else avoid making that mistake. And that's really why I wrote this book and why I started the company.
Radical candor. Now, in a workplace or anywhere else, we know that for humans, this is a very challenging idea, right?
I mean, yes.
Hey, how you doing? We don't really mean it. And I'm doing fine. That's not what we're really, may not be what's going on. I mean, in a thousand
Almost
social
never.
Settings, we don't practice radical candor. Or if we do, it's kind of a special skill that not that many people are really good at. Most people pretty much avoid it, don't they? Is it? It's like kryptonite. It's very strong, but how do you pull it out in the office without everybody, you know, falling down?
Running, yeah. It's a really good question. I mean, at its essence, radical candor seems really simple. It's about caring personally at the same time that you're willing to challenge directly. But we're all unwilling to challenge each other directly because we've been told from the moment we learn to speak, from the moment we're 18 months old, if you don't have anything nice to say, don't say it at all. And now, if you become a boss, it's your job to say it. And I would argue, frankly, as a citizen of this country, it's also your job to say it often, more often than we do, probably. And so but the question is, the vast majority of people are really good, kind people. And so how can we learn how to say it without failing to show that we care personally? And that's what radical candor is. Now, one of the things that I did to try to make it a little bit easier is to remind people what happens with some strong language when you fail on one dimension or another. So when you challenge directly, but you fail to show that you care personally, I call that obnoxious aggression, right?
Okay.
And it's tempting to call that sort of the asshole quadrant. But I don't do that. I don't do that for a very important reason. The way to think about radical candor is not as a judgment of yourself or as other people, but as a guide to help you move in the right direction in conversations you're having.
Wait a minute. Not a judgment, but isn't it fundamentally a judgment? You're judging performance. You're judging how people are operating, maybe how you are operating yourself.
The key thing, one of the most important things that I recommend to bosses, new bosses or even extremely experienced ones, is that when you're offering feedback, as it's commonly called, or guidance, as I call it in the book, but that's basically, either way, it's praise and criticism. When you're offering those things, it's really important not to criticize somebody's personality, right? Because the whole purpose of feedback is to make a change for the better. And it's so difficult to change your personality. There's no real point in either saying, the problem here is you're stupid, or this went well because you're smart. Because those kinds of attributes are so difficult to change. Not impossible, as Carol Dweck has taught us, but so difficult to change. You want to focus on behavior or on work, on stuff that can be changed. Really important.
Of course, stupid and smart are only two vectors, right? There's many aspects of personality that can directly affect work performance, I suppose. You've worked at Apple. You worked at Google. Have you been in settings where radical candor was employed there? Or is that the general rule there? Or even in those companies, as successful as they are, is it a challenge?
It's always a challenge because so many of us have been taught from a very young age, if you don't have anything nice to say, don't say it at all. But the cultures at both Google and Apple really encouraged people to say what they really thought in a respectful way to one another. So, simple example that happened to me shortly after I joined Google, I had to give a presentation to Google's founders and CEO about how the business that I was leading, the AdSense business, was doing. And like any normal person going into such a meeting, I felt a little bit nervous. Now, luckily, my boss, who was Sheryl Sandberg at the time she was at Google, was in the room and supportive. So I felt a little better, but still, I was a little nervous. But as soon as I said how many new customers we had added, Eric Schmidt, who was the CEO at the time, jerked his head up and said, "What resources do you need to make to keep this going. Amazing. This is astounding results. And so, you know, I felt like the meeting had gone pretty well.
Yeah.
In fact, I felt like a genius. And so as I'm walking out the door, I'm expecting sort of a high five from my boss. And instead she said to me, why don't you walk back to my office with me?
And this is Sheryl Sandberg saying.
This is Sheryl Sandberg.
Okay.
And so I thought, I've done something wrong, and I'm sure I'm about to hear what it was.
Yep.
But she started out describing the things that had gone well, and not in a feedback sandwich insincere kind of way, but useful, yep, to, mm-hmm, know. But of course, what I really wanted to know was what I had screwed up. And eventually she said to me, "You said a lot in there. Were you aware of it?" And I sort of made a brush-off gesture with my hand because I was breathing at this point a huge sigh of relief.
Right.
If that was all I had done wrong, it was really
no big deal. Okay,
right,
yeah.
Who cares? And she said, "I know a really good speech coach, and
wow,
Google would pay for it. Do you want an introduction?" And I'm busy at the time. That, remember, this business is on fire,
sure,
growing. And I kind of make this brush-off gesture with my hand again. And I said, "You know, I'm busy. I don't really have time. It's no big deal." And then Sheryl stopped and she looked me right in the eye and she said, "I can see when you make that brush off gesture with your hand that I'm going to have to be a lot more direct with you. When you say every third word, it makes you sound stupid." Now she has my full attention.
Yes.
And a lot of people would say it was mean to say that I sounded stupid. But it was actually the kindest thing she could possibly have done for me in my career at that moment. And remember, she didn't start off by saying I sounded stupid. She also didn't, mm-hmm, say I was stupid. But because she saw that I was blowing her off and because she knew me well, she realized she was going to have to say it extremely clearly in the words that I would listen to. And she found those words. And I went to the speech coach. And I learned that she really wasn't exaggerating. I did say every third word.
Eric Schmidt still liked your presentation.
Thank heavens. Thank heavens. Got those resources.
But there's Kim Scott learning from Sheryl Sandberg. Kim, stand by there. We want to dive on into what makes a good boss a bad boss. Kim Scott's new book is Radical Candor, Be a Kick-Ass Boss Without Losing Your Humanity. Here's Roy Orbison. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
So I'm picking him up and I'm laying him down. I believe he's gonna work me into the ground. I pull to the left, I heave to the right. I ought to kill him, but it wouldn't be right. Cause I'm working for the man. Working for the man. I gotta make him a hand. Working for the man.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about effective bosses and what makes them. Kim Scott says, tell it like it is. Expect the same in return. Her new book is Radical Candor. Be a kick-ass boss without losing your humanity. Worked at Google, worked at Apple. Steve Jobs, here's a little bit from the movie Jobs. 2013, Ashton Kutcher depicts a scene in which Steve Jobs, who was known for his tyrannical leadership style, fires an employee.
If you don't share our enthusiasm and care for the vision of this company.
No. I'm not understanding.
Get out.
What?
Get your and get out. You're done.
What are you going to be? You going to fire me?
No! I already fired you! Why are you still here?
Okay, Ashton Kutcher in the movie Jobs. And what do you think of that style? You can join us this hour. Are you the boss? How's it going? What advice do you need? Are you the under a boss? Practically everybody is. Is it a good boss, a bad boss? And what do you think of the strategy of radical candor? How does a boss practice radical candor without coming across as a jerk? Kim Scott joins us from Stanford, California. A lot of calls for you, Kim, and we want to dive on into your way here as well. But let's hear some experience from around the country. College Park, Georgia. David's calling. Hi, David. You're on the air with Kim.
Hi,
hey,
David.
Don, how are you?
Hi. What's your story?
Hey, Kim. So I have an interesting story. I was it's not a corporate job, but I was a bartender last year here in College Park for a little while, and I had an interesting experience with my boss. He was easily angered, to say the least.
Okay.
But he would kind of yell at us for the sake of yelling at us, and I ultimately was fired on the spot and kicked out of the bar, kind of just like that scene from the movie that you just played.
Great.
For just standing up to him and asking him. He made one of my coworkers cry because he was yelling at us, and I just told him, hey, you know, you got to show us a little respect, and in return, you know, we'll give you that respect back. And then he freaked out and threw me out of the bar. And to say the least, the bar is not in business anymore. But I kind of had the thought, and I don't know if you had done any research on this in writing your book, but I feel like maybe that method, the discipline for discipline's sake, is something maybe a little aged. That's something that, like, younger millennials and other people are kind of not tolerating that anymore, whereas maybe my grandfather or somebody would have kind of accepted the authoritative discipline for discipline's sake, and you've got to just do what your boss says, and you've got to just stand up and accept that you have this job. But for me, that kind of thing doesn't fly.
David, we've got it. Kim, speak to that. Bad boss in the bartending arena. David stood up to him and got thrown out. But he's got this question about, you know, whether there's a evolution of how a new generation takes discipline or authoritarian kind of leadership. But speak to that circumstance, Kim. Very, very basic. You know, bartending.
Yeah, very, very painful. I once had a boss who was similarly sort of belittling. In fact, he was so belittling that I shrunk half an inch. Literally, my doctor measured me while I was working for him. So you did the right thing to stand up to stand up to him. His behavior sounds like it would fall squarely in the obnoxious aggression quadrant, as the portrayal of Jobs in the movie. I think that the most important thing that you can do is to stand up to that kind of obnoxious behavior, because you're right, it doesn't work anymore. I think there's been an evolution of management. For most of humanity, we accomplished great things, collective things, through terrible brutality, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then the Industrial Revolution came along, and we sort of replaced bureaucracy with brutality, but there's still some brutality in bureaucracy, as we've all seen.
Mm-hmm.
And now I think this new generation of managers, their goal is to build relationships, and you cannot build relationships through authoritarian means. So I totally agree with you, David. This kind of discipline for discipline's sake or authoritarian, unchecked authoritarian management style doesn't work anymore.
David, would you have been open to radical candor from the boss if he had a better delivery? But what does a bartending boss care about? I guess he cares about the speed with which drinks are made and the quality, you know, how they're put together. I mean, if he had been in there, kind of in your face, but in an empathetic way, would you have welcomed that?
Absolutely. And, you know, if I felt like I had done something wrong and he had approached me respectfully, but even with discipline, you know, that's something that I feel like I would have been responsive to. But, it reached a point when he literally was yelling at me, like, I don't care if what I'm telling you to do is wrong, you do it. You know, that kind of thing.
yeah.
Great.
Good for you for standing up.
But what century is that
for
from?
Sure, but for sure, I would have been much... I actually really liked the job. I mean, bartending is really fun, and you get to meet a lot of people and stuff like that. So, for sure. I mean, it's the kind of business where you need to be personable with your employees, and your employees are the ones who are building the relationships with the customers and such. So,
and you would have been open to the candor, because candor can sometimes, you know, pinch a little bit. But I appreciate your call. Thank you very much, David, there in Georgia. Kim, take us around your quadrant here. You've got a kind of a chart here of different styles of bossing or leadership. You've got ruinous empathy as one, what, a terrible swamp. Manipulative
yes.
insincerity is another no-go zone. Obnoxious aggression. And then your dream paradise, radical candor. Take us through each of those, ruinous empathy and right on around.
Absolutely. So ruinous empathy is actually, in my experience, the mistake that gets made most often at work and really in any human relationship. Ruinous empathy happens when you do show that you care about the person. So not at all what David's boss did.
Right.
But you fail to challenge the person. So sort of what I did to poor old Bob in my story is I just wanted to be nice to him. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't tell him when he was screwing up. And then I had to fire him. Not so nice after all, right? Mm-hmm. So that's ruinous empathy. You don't grow. You don't get better. You don't resolve disagreements in ruinous empathy, although people are nice. So that's the most common mistake. And then obnoxious aggression is what happens when you do challenge someone, mm-hmm. but you fail to show you care. And that's it's interesting because we get more stories about obnoxious aggression because they engage our lizard brain and because the stories are fun to tell.
Yep.
It's sort of hard to tell a story about ruinous empathy, but it's the more common mistake, I think, that gets made. And then, of course, there's the worst quadrant of all, which is where you neither show that you care nor challenge. That's what I call manipulative insincerity. That's where office politics gets born. That's where passive-aggressive behavior happens, that sort of thing.
Give us examples. What is manipulative insincerity? What kind of office or boss behavior would demonstrate that?
Well, so again, I don't want you to use these labels for other people. So I'll tell you a story about my own hero's journey from obnoxious aggression to manipulative insincerity.
Oh, what a
this
journey.
Also, yes, what a journey. But we all go on it. I think when you hear my story, you probably, even you, Tom, have probably made this mistake.
Okay.
So it all started with some obnoxious behavior on my part. Also, shortly after I joined Google, I got into an argument with Larry Page about an AdSense policy.
You're bold.
I know. Well,
let's argue with the founder right here, right
yeah,
now.
Yeah. Okay. That was the great thing about Google's culture was that mm-hmm. we were all encouraged to argue. It wasn't actually that bold. I probably wouldn't have done it in another environment. Mm-hmm. But in that environment, I was emboldened.
Okay.
And I got into an argument. And instead of being radically candid, however, I was obnoxiously aggressive. I sent an email to Larry and about 30 other people that said, Larry claims he wants to organize the world's information, but if it'll make us a buck, he's willing to create clutter sites muddling the world's information.
Okay.
Now, that was dumb, right?
Maybe there's a better way of putting it. I don't know.
It's worth taking a minute to explain why I did such a dumb thing, because a lot of other people make similar mistakes. And the reason is that I believe, probably like you and everybody listening, that there's a special place in hell for people who kiss up and kick down. But it doesn't mean doing exactly the opposite is so great either, right? Caring personally is something that you owe to everyone you work with, regardless of their position. So don't treat your employees like they're pawns on a chessboard, but don't treat your boss or the founder of like he's a tyrant to be toppled. So that was the first mistake. But of course, the crime is never as bad as the cover-up. I learned later that Larry thought my email was pretty funny, actually, and he took it with a good sense of humor. But a friend of mine called me and said, why did you send that obnoxious email? And so here's my descent to manipulative insincerity.
Yeah.
I realized that I had been incredibly obnoxious, and the next time I saw Larry, I apologized. I said, Larry, I'm sorry about that email. I realized that you were right and I was wrong. Now, only two problems with that. The first, and the major problem was that I was lying. I didn't actually understand yet that I was wrong. I was, of course, wrong. Wrong about my understanding of the policy and also very wrong about my assertion that Larry was greedy, which he's not. He's actually a very, very ethical human being. But anyway, So the first problem was that I was lying. The second problem was that Larry knew I was lying because he's got a pretty good BS meter.
Yeah.
And it was, he kind of walked off with a expression on his face that made me cringe and made the guy sitting next to me cringe and kind of pat me on the shoulder and say, he likes it better when you
be straight,
when you disagree. But the problem here is that often when we have been obnoxious, what we do is we move the wrong direction on the challenge directly dimension.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of moving the right direction on the care personally dimension. So what I should have done is shown Larry some common human decency rather than lying.
I mean, a lot of what you're describing here sounds like bring your full humanity to these relationships, your honest, full humanity. See the person, be seen, be open enough to be seen, and say what you think. But that's kind of a Zen state, you know. Not that many people achieve that in life.
Yes, you're right. And that's the second. So the first part of what makes radical candor hard is being told when we're 18 months old, if you don't have anything nice to say, don't say it at all. The second thing that makes it really hard is that right around the time we're 18, 19, 20, we're getting our first job. And we're at that moment in our lives when our egos are still quite fragile. I guess mine still is, and I'm pushing 50. But it was more fragile when I was 18. And our personas are beginning to solidify. And right at that moment in our lives, we're told, be professional.
Mm-hmm.
And for an awful lot of people, that means leave your emotions, leave your humanity, leave the very best part of yourself at home, and come to work as some sort of semi-human. And that's terrible. One of Cheryl's mantras on her team at Google, and I'm sure still is her mantra at Facebook, is bring your whole self to work.
Yeah.
Such a powerful statement, and such a simple statement, but so rare.
Gina in Nashville, Tennessee. Gina, you're on the air with Kim in California.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Excuse me. About, I'd say probably a little over 20 years ago, I was in a job interview, and I got asked a question that, to the best of my recollection, I was not able to answer. But for almost a quarter of a century, it has haunted me because I've never been able to answer it.
Completely. Oh, my gosh. What's the question? What's the Holy Grail question here?
The question was, if I had a choice for a boss, would I want a competent jerk or a nice idiot?
Lousy choices.
That threw my world into complete utter confusion because I was like, wow.
Yeah,
now I have to choose between, you know, these things I either hate, which is incompetence and just a really bad attitude as a human, and things that I love, which is competency and humanity. And it's like, you know, you got to, it's either or, you can't.
But in that either or, I mean, a nice idiot may be very humane, maybe, but not necessarily going to be competent if you're really right. It's an idiot, right, Gina?
Right. And there are some bosses out there that have, you know, that can have this idea of, you know, well, yeah, I'm your boss, but I want to be your best friend. And other bosses that are like, you know, look, I would rather be in my 40-foot RV down in Florida than be here. But, you know, this is the way it is, and I'm going to be a jerk. I'm going to remind you of that every day.
Fantastic. Kim, you're listening to that. Why?
Yes.
Do people tend to steer to those poles or be drawn to those poles, competent jerk or nice idiot? Why not something better in the middle?
Gina, I love that question because when I first became, you know, I'm from Memphis, by the way, you and I must be somehow related because this question was central to my coming up with the notion of radical candor. So when I started a software company back in 2000, it was a very hard moment for me. A friend summed it up well. She said, you know, you started this company because you hate the man, and now you are the man. And I had all this, and being a woman, it was even more complicated, right?
Yeah.
So I had all this ambivalence about sort of assuming a position of authority in this company. And shortly after I started the company, I got an email from about 10 people who worked for me who posed that exact dilemma, Gina, the most people would rather, it turned out, according to this article, most people would choose the competent than the incompetent nice boss. And I thought, are they sending me this because I'm a jerk or because I'm incompetent? I'm not sure. Like, are those my choices as a leader? Certainly, there's another way. And that's a big part of what radical candor is. You don't have to make that choice. You don't have to be either obnoxiously aggressive or ruinously empathetic. You can care personally at the same time that you challenge directly. In fact, I would argue if you really do care personally about the people who report directly to you, you will challenge them because that's what's going to help them grow. But you'll challenge them with love.
Does everybody have the capacity to thread that needle?
Yes, everyone does have the. This can absolutely be taught.
Kim Scott's new book is Radical Candor, Be a Kick-Ass Boss Without Losing Your Humanity. She's with us today from Stanford, California, out of Apple, out of Google, thinking about how to be that really good boss. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Here's Jimmy Reed with Big Boss Man.
Got me waking, boss man, waking around the fire. I want a little rain or water, but you won't let Jimmy start, big boss man. Can't you hear me when I call? Well, you ain't so big. You just told us all.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about effective bosses and what makes them. Kim Scott says, tell it like it is and expect the same in return. She's been there in the boss land of Google, of Apple, and beyond. Had some failures with some startups and her bossing style there, but she's learned. Her new book is Radical Candor, Be a Kick-Ass Boss Without Losing Your Humanity. You can join us. What's your best good boss story, your best bad boss story? If you could change your boss's style or approach, what's the change you'd make? And bosses, how would you like to change yourself, your staff? Be candid with us here. Kim joins us from Stanford, California today. And Jonathan is calling from Bowling Green, Kentucky. Jonathan, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Kim.
Hi.
Hey, Jonathan.
Yeah, I am currently, my vocation is commission-based sales. And all the money I make is contingent upon the guy who hired me. He sets up places to sell our product and so on and does turn-in of our orders and whatnot. Anyway, a lot that I go through with him was not really what was in the brochure when I signed on for this particular trip. So my question, I guess, would be, how does one practice radical frankness of speech? I'm incredibly passive, too, to a fault. But it's affecting my ability to make money. I have a wife, two kids. So honestly, I would like to be able to get my point across to this gentleman. But he tends to be abrasive and aggressive. And I guess I'm just asking, what would be the best way as an employee to go about enacting frankness of speech?
Such a great question. Great. And so important to be radically candid with your boss, right? Because work becomes awful if you can't say what you think, especially to your boss. So here are some quick tips for speaking truth to power safely. Once I gave a talk and somebody tweeted at me afterwards, tried radical candor with my boss, got fired. And I felt terrible. What can I do? How can I help? And he said, actually, I'm better off. Thank you for prompting me. But that got me to thinking I got to give people some tips so that doesn't happen again. So I think the first thing to do is to start by soliciting feedback. And this basically is true whether you are the boss or you're giving radical candor to your boss. But start with soliciting feedback. It's really important to understand the other person's perspective before you launch in. And make sure, don't just say, how's it going? How am I doing? Because then nobody likes to give feedback. The person will inevitably say, oh, it's fine. And then you will have learned nothing. So you've got to really put them on the spot. You've got to be willing to say, I really want to know, and come up with a question. Is there anything I could do or stop doing that would make it easier to work with me? And then hold their feet to the fire. Make sure you learn something. And then make sure you act on what you learn so that they see sort of the spirit with which you're about to offer the feedback.
Kim, can I get in there first?
Absolutely.
How are you getting? You say you got to get something out of them. You got to get some. How do you elicit that without, you know, making an aggressive boss angry?
Yeah. So I mean, I have found that if you say some version of, and you got to say it in the way that's comfortable for you,
yeah.
But am I doing something or not doing something that bugs you?
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah,
and then shut your mouth. It's mm-hmm. really hard.
Yep.
Count to six in your head. I just counted to two and that felt like a long time,
yeah.
Right? So count all the way to six in your head. Almost nobody can endure that kind of silence.
Mm-hmm.
They will tell you something. And then, of course, your job is not to get defensive.
Mm-hmm.
Listen with the intent to understand what that person is thinking. And even if you disagree with 95% of what they say, find that 5% nugget where you do agree and act on that nugget. And then a couple of days later, when you're feeling, if you agree with 100% or 80% of what they're saying, like fix the problem, that's
mm-hmm.
the most important thing you can do. But if you disagree, sometimes the best thing you can do is go back when you're calm, when you're in a non-defensive place, and explain your position. And then you have to sort of listen, challenge, commit at a certain point. But you can, in other words, agree to disagree. But when somebody gives you feedback, it's a gift, and it's a gift in one of two ways. Either it allows you to see a problem that you can now fix, or it allows you to fix their misperception of the situation. So that's my advice for soliciting feedback. Does that make sense, Tom?
It makes sense to me. Jonathan, what do you say?
Yeah, I mean, it makes perfect sense to me. A lot of the problem I find with my current boss is that the man's been in sales his whole life and is so tactful when it comes to words that the guy can have you agreeing with him before you realize you're agreeing with him.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, I have no idea how to get my point across because I haven't been in sales my whole life. I'm not used
right.
to influencing people necessarily.
Jedi mind tricks from
yes.
him. That's why if you ask him to criticize you, you're going to learn something that's going to help you when it comes time for you to criticize him. The next step after you've heard his perspective is to say, probably there's more stuff going well than going badly, in a way that doesn't feel like kissing up or something like that. Tell him what he does that you like so that he knows what you appreciate, so he knows it's not all bad. Usually there's more good stuff than bad stuff happening. And then after you've solicited criticism from him and given him some praise, now it's time for you to ask him a simple question. You know, there's something that's bothering me. Is it okay if I tell you about it? Now, if he says no, my advice to you is to polish up your resume, right, and go look for work elsewhere. But if he says yes, then say it. And say it in a way that is sort of, you know, you're not now in a negotiation. You want him to understand.
It's and a if candor he begins, zone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. If he begins arguing with you, you can even try explain draw the radical candor framework. Draw a vertical line, which is care personally. Draw a horizontal line, which is challenge directly. And if you feel like he's selling you something and not really challenging you directly, say, you know, I feel like you're being ruinously empathetic with me. What I want to know is what you really think, and what I want to be able to tell you here is what I really think about this situation.
Mm-hmm. Boy, to pull it on to that ground of candor is so satisfying when you can pull it off. But that is hard for people. It's kind of an enlightened being, a living Buddha who can really do that with regularity.
It does. You don't have to be the Buddha to do this. It's very interesting. When I taught managing at Apple, we found that just having a shared vocabulary, and this is borne out at dozens of other organizations, just having a shared vocabulary to say to somebody, hey, I feel like you're being obnoxiously aggressive, or I feel like you're being ruinously empathetic. Like I want to hear.
Don't empathize
your candor
so much with me. Give it to me straight.
Right, right. And I want to be able to give it to you straight. And just to sort of check in throughout a conversation and say, how's this landing for you? Because one of the really important things about radical candor is that it doesn't get measured at your mouth. It gets measured at the other person's ear. Mm-hmm. And that's why it's so important when you go in these conversations to have these conversations in person, because most of communication is nonverbal. Unless we're on the radio. But if you're going to have this kind of radically candid conversation, you want to be able to see, as Cheryl did with me, when they're making a brush-off gesture, when they're getting upset, you want to be able to see those emotional cues and react to them with compassion, right? So you want to do it in person. You want to go into the conversation with remembering that you could be wrong. You want to be humble when you're having these conversations. You want to go into it with the spirit that you're being helpful, that you're not trying to kick somebody in the shins or prove that you're smarter or better than they are or more powerful in some way. You want to go in with a spirit of helpfulness. You want to say this stuff right away, especially when you're giving feedback to your boss. Because we're reluctant in any case to do it, but we're especially reluctant to do it with our boss, you tend to bottle it up. Yep. That was why I shrunk half an inch with that terrible boss I had. Not because he was so terrible, but because I was bottling up my anger, and it felt terrible. So you want to do it right away. You want to praise in public, criticize in private. And most importantly, we talked about this before, but it bears repeating, you don't want to criticize or praise somebody's personality, because our personality attributes are so hard to change. If you want them to change something, you want to criticize something that it's possible for them to change. Or if you want them to repeat something that's good, you want to praise something that they can repeat.
Kim, stand by.
They can do again.
Yep. Jonathan, that's a terrific rundown right there. And Jonathan, I really appreciate your call. Good luck. Two kids to feed and all the rest. Nicholas in Norfolk, Virginia. Nicholas, you're on the air. Thank you for calling. You're on with Kim Scott.
Hello, sir. Hello, ma'am. My name is
Nicholas.
Pastor Hastings. I've been in the Navy for 11 and a half years, and I've seen every kind of leadership style you could possibly imagine.
I bet.
And I know your time's limited, so I'll keep it short.
Yeah.
So one of the things I've observed is pretty much everything young lady on the radio has been talking about, and it's you have to be direct. Whenever you transition, whenever you take over in a new place, because that's what we do a lot in the military is move and start over, you have to shift as hard as you can and don't go back. Like everybody always wants to ease into everything. Mm-hmm. Can't do that. I'm a nuclear operator, so I deal with a lot of really smart type A personalities. And so whenever you need to get your point across to these kind of people, like the biggest thing is if you have a bad boss, because in the military, it's really hard to get your boss fired. Mm-hmm. You have to find a way to motivate them to work, because I've had every kind of lazy yellers. You're going to yell three times at any job before you're labeled a screamer. And I've met plenty. And the thing that I've observed the most is if you want somebody to do their job, but there's no incentive for your approval, just ask them for status updates next to somebody that they respect. And if you're trying to motivate somebody below you to work, let them see you work. Because the second they realize that everybody gets the same direct treatment, you don't mince words, you don't say it quiet. You say, this is exactly what you're doing, this is exactly what we need, and then move on.
And you're saying do it with an audience, you're saying, Nicholas.
In the event that you're dealing with a boss, you do the audience with somebody they respect. It doesn't have to be their boss. It could be their friend or somebody else that's at their pay grade.
Wow. I can just hear how you've learned to work that military system and you're paying close attention as a nuclear operator. I guess it matters. Nicholas, I appreciate your call. Kim, what about radical candor and how we pull, maybe triangulate, bring in a wingman or woman to get the candor rolling?
I think it's a really, really great point, especially when you're talking about praise. The purpose of praise is to let people know what to do more of. And when you praise in public, you're not just talking to one person, you get real leverage and everybody learns what to do more of. I have found if you want to criticize in public, there's two ways to do it. One is to criticize yourself in public and to show why criticism is so helpful. Mm-hmm. Another is to allow a team of people to self-criticize in public. So one of the things that I used to do at Google was to bring, this is a super high-tech solution to the question of radical candor. I used to bring a stuffed monkey to my screaming, flying stuffed monkey to my team meetings. and I would sit it on the desk and I would say, anybody who has screwed up this week, I want to hear about it. And if you tell the story, you get instant forgiveness and you also share with the rest of the team what not to do. And the third good thing that'll happen is that we'll all realize together that we all make mistakes, and that will make innovation easier because making changes is
part of it.
Part of it. As I told my kids, you learn to ice skate by falling down. So when we started doing this, it was astounding how many people would come forward with their stories, and they were funny stories usually too. So it was a very cathartic experience. So I think figuring out how to use an audience is a brilliant way to achieve radical candor, but you've got to be careful not to engage somebody's lizard brain. So if you criticize somebody in public, and there's a fine line between criticism, public debate is a good thing, public criticism is a bad thing. But I think the military is brilliant. My co-founder is Russ Laraway, who was a Marine for many years. And the thinking that's been done in the military about leadership is, I'm in awe of. I really have a lot of respect for it.
You mentioned just in passing, right at the top of the show, how this is important in national terms as well. What are you thinking about there?
I believe that as American citizens, we are all bosses. Every single person who votes in this country is a boss, because our job as voters is to hold our government accountable and to hold ourselves accountable. And I think that one of the examples of ruinous empathy that we see in our culture is this notion that politics divides. Don't talk about it. And I think we've got to start talking about it with each other and challenging each other directly in a way that shows we care if we're going to move out of our current political quagmire.
Radical candor across all kinds of environments there. Is it catching on? Do you think it's the way of the future? Radical candor?
I think so.
Kim Scott's pretty invested in it. Her new book is Radical Candor, Be a Kick-Ass Boss Without Losing Your Humanity. I'd say you've got to have your humanity to be that kind of boss. Kim, this has been really interesting. Thank you very much for being with us today. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Kim Scott, CEO of Candor, Inc., author of Radical Candor. Listeners, thanks for joining us today. We'll go out with a little bit of James Brown and The Boss. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Having fun, got money fun. Got money fun, 'cause I paid the cost.